Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the second installment of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. I'm Andrew Olson, and I'm here with my colleague and good friend, Roy Jones.
Andrew, hey, great to be with you today. I'm really excited about our time together today. We're going to be talking to a mentor of mine, Dan Shepherd. And I first met Dan just after he had left Virginia Tech University, where he was the head of development in the School of Business there. And you know, he came in and did a training for our team when I was at Liberty University. And it truly was transformational for us. You know, Dan has a business now. He helps nonprofits like we do, Andrew. The moniker is the Frontline Fundraiser. It's frontlinefundraiser.com, right, Dan?
Roger that.
And it is such an honor to have you here. The thing that jumps out to me that I remembered, and I had been involved in development for 20 years before I met you, and I was one of these guys. I learned major gift development in the political campaign world. And so I was one of these guys that was pretty hard hitting. I mean, I really was a salesman and a closer, and I pushed and high pressured and raised some money in the process. But after spending a week with you, I realized I'd been doing it wrong. And I really moved to more of a conversational presentation. I just look forward to hearing you talk about that some today.
Well, I appreciate that. I could begin to riff and ramble, but if you want a more structured format, you might want to lead me some.
Well, talk about, you know, I know the thing that was just really interesting to me in those days, and of course it's been, I don't want to date us, but it's been over a decade ago since you first started mentoring me, but you had a series that at that time you called The Signals. And you've now kind of transformed it into the why, what, and how, and will you. And I want you to drill down on that some. Talk about how you made, you know, that just that transformation, your conversational approach as opposed to pitching and arm twisting like I used to do, and asking people for, you know, to support organizations, ministries, and charities.
Yeah, and in fairness, it's the way I did it in early in my career until – the best way I can describe it is that I had an epiphany. It was at a conference, and I was commiserating with some friends about some gifts that I thought were going to close that didn't. And one of my friends looked at me and said, Dan, you might just want to do a little hindsight analysis. And, well, I did. And I looked not only at some of the gifts that I'd missed, but I thought, well, let's look at what does work as well as what doesn't. And it dawned on me that when I got to yes, my donors were making four decisions, and they were deciding, why do I care enough to have led a fundraiser in my living room? What do I care especially about, because I know he's here to ask me for money? And then they were thinking, well, how could I afford to do this? And that's the magic part, which we'll talk about in a little more detail. And then what I realized is that if I were proactive in pursuing that agenda and helping them answer, why do I care? What do I especially care about? How could I make a gift? Then when I got to will you, they had already pretty well decided, well, yes, I will. And it was just, it was transformative.
Very interesting. Andrew, did you see kind of the same kind of thing? I'm thinking about your background working with hospitals. Does that mirror what Dan and I have seen in the university setting?
It does, really. And, you know, I can point to a couple of times when we thought we were going to get those big gifts and didn't. And, you know, I think if I were to deconstruct those relationships and those, you know, conversations leading up to the ask, I could probably pinpoint two or three of these items that we either didn't probe enough on with those donors or completely missed. So I can see exactly how this methodology makes a lot of sense. I have a follow-up question. So it takes, I think, someone who's particularly comfortable with self-reflection to ask those questions on a regular basis and to sort of, you know, watch the post-game highlight reel to see, okay, what did I do well, what did I do poorly? And I find that not everybody is comfortable with that, especially because so many of us in the development world are essentially people pleasers. It's hard sometimes to really step back and have an honest accounting on that. So Dan, I'd be curious to know, in your coaching and consulting, do you find that to be the case? And if so, how do you get around it? Or am I just off base?
Oh, no, it's a really astute question, Andrew. And that sort of introspection, of course, had to begin with me as I realized, well, if this is in fact what my donors are deciding, my first task is to help teach them that those are the decisions they're making, because they weren't, well, hardly ever consciously aware that that was the thought process they were going through. So I had to learn through trial and error how to intentionally invite a conversation about why and pursue the details and probe the depths of their emotional foundation with the relationship. And then I had to figure out how to ask about what is it you'd like to support if I could help you find a way to do that. And then, of course,
Let me jump in. It's really interesting to me that you talk about teaching the donor. Philanthropy really is a learned behavior, isn't it?
Oh, sure. I think that's well put.
Well, you said it.
Yeah. So the part about how the gift might be made is where the really big gifts live. As soon as any fundraiser understands that really significant charitable gifts don't come from income, from the checkbook, they come from appreciated assets. And to get the couple sitting across the coffee table from you to stop thinking about how big a check can I afford to write today, to thinking about things like life events and milestones, things that happen in people's lives that sometime invite them to allocate assets. Sometimes life events require them to allocate assets. And then to turn their attention to the tax implications of those asset allocations, to talk about what's coming up that's important to me and the people I love, and to put all of those parts together to help them realize that, well, maybe I can afford to make a gift, and maybe I don't need to make the gift today. Maybe the best gift plan for me will be something that happens later, a testamentary gift. We might find a gift that provides somebody an income stream to specifically address a life event. Or, everybody's favorite, we might find a blended gift that has a little bit of each.
Right.
And it's just a treat to be able to take somebody through that process, through that agenda.
Where do you see financially, I'm just thinking about, you know, the different organizations I've worked with, I've gone in and some folks have said a major gift is $500. Of course, I immediately add a zero to that formula. But, you know, then, you know, I see some larger nonprofits where a major gift is not till you get to $100,000. You know, this kind of move from just the checkbook to appreciated assets, what kind of dollar level in the gift do you see that normally happen, Dan?
That's one of my favorite soapbox topics, Roy. Definitions. Let's start with the industry accepted definition of a major gift. First of all, at just about any nonprofit, there is that minimum threshold. Here, a major gift is $1,000. There, a major gift is $100,000. And that's good to know when you're thinking about your performance review, whether your contract's going to be renewed.
We've all done some of that.
Sure. And we're smart, too. And then there's the industry accepted definition of a major gift. It's an occasional gift that's substantially bigger than somebody's annual gift. Well, that makes sense too, but we're forgetting the definition from the other side of the coffee table. If you were to ask them, a major gift is one that I think I just have to pause and think about. I'll give you my favorite example. It goes back to my time working in higher education. Florida State University, the athletic supporters at the highest level are called the Golden Chiefs. When I was there, a Golden Chief gave to FSU Athletics $5,000 a year. Every December, write a check. Now, do you suppose that athletic donor had to pause and think much about writing a $5,000 check every December? It was his annual gift.
Right.
The whole point is let the donor participate in deciding where his bar is set. Let him decide what's a major gift, and that's an emotion-based decision as much as it is financial.
Yeah, it really is. It's about them, not about us, right?
Yeah, that's one of the great lessons that fundraisers who have any success will learn sooner or later. It's about the donor.
So I've got a follow-up on that. And when you were talking about sort of the four pillars for you, you know, one of them you said is, you know, what do I especially care about? And then you just said, it's about the donor. So help me square that and help our listeners square that with the constant pressure that I'm sure you see with your clients and organizations you serve. And Roy, I know you and I have talked about this ad nauseum, but the constant pressure to quote unquote, just raise unrestricted operating dollars. I find that it's so much easier to have an authentic conversation with someone that you're going to ask for a significant gift from when, like you said, Dan, it's on their terms and it's funding something that they care deeply about. When that's not the organization's primary financial priority, how do you help a development officer, an executive director, and a board wrap their brains around doing this differently to the point where they can still raise the revenue they need to operate, but also honor what's important to the donor?
Yeah, I think that may be nowhere more true than in healthcare fundraising, because the doctors want new toys to play with. The tongue out of my cheek version of that is they want the diagnostic and treatment equipment that will save people's lives. And those are immediate, urgent needs. And we have to absolutely embrace and get that. The academic dean wants operating money, and the dean wants unrestricted money so the dean can decide how it's spent. And that's all terrific. The donor may not agree. So the fundraiser is potentially stuck between a rock and a hard place. I've got to please the physicians. I've got to please my dean. That means current money. And being an honest agent for the donor. If the donor really wants to do something, it's probably to my benefit to listen to what the donor might want to do. The way I found after a lot of practice that it worked for me was to say, you know, when I got to that point in the relationship where we were talking about if money wasn't an object, where at our nonprofit would you like to make a financial impact? And some of them simply wouldn't know what the possibilities were. So I'd say, let me help you and guide you a little bit. Now, we have a current priority right now. The dean is particularly interested in money for this program or that project. And then I'd pause briefly to see if it got some kind of a signal, which goes back to what I initially taught Roy. It's all about looking for the signals. And if not, I would say, that's okay. If that doesn't resonate with you, then your gift plan might be for unrestricted purposes to trust our leadership to do with your gifts the best things for our nonprofit. You might want to make a gift that promotes some particular program that's more important to you. You might want to make a gift that supports the people we serve, our patients, our students, our constituents, our clients, or you might want to make a gift that supports the people who provide those services, our faculty, the physicians, the artistic staff, etc. And then, of course, if we were raising capital dollars, I would mention the campaign. But to be intentional about talking about what you might be interested in is really, really key. You please the dean or the doctor by saying, our priority is this, but you allow the donor to participate. What's your interest? And you do it intentionally.
There's really a shift that's got to happen, right? Where you, in the conversation, begin to represent the donor and not necessarily the charity. You know, you're going through this discovery process and finding out where their heart is, where their intentions are, where their philanthropic intent is, and then becoming their advocate back at the institution.
Exactly. And getting back to pleasing the boss, sometimes I was able to talk with my dean to say, well, I could have come home with a $1,000 gift for this thing, Dean, but instead we're talking about a gift that's made in another way, but we're talking about $100,000. Do you want me to stop?
Great point.
I kept my jobs.
Yeah. The numbers don't lie. How long do you think, and I know all of us probably have different experiences with this, but to get the donor in the relationship to where they're willing to share their hearts and intentions, how long does that usually take a major gift officer? Can you do it in the first time you sit down with them, or does it take a time or two?
It almost never happens at the first meeting. That's why the field is called development. We're developing relationships, and everyone goes at its own pace. But if you know from the moment you decide, I want to meet with these people based on what our research says about them, and you decide to pick up the phone, if you know what you want the relationship to look like, then you can allow it to happen at its own pace because you know the agenda. You know that no matter how long it takes us to pursue it, if they decide to come along for this conversational journey, then we're going to discuss why you care. And I'll be happy to spend time learning why you care, because when you tell me why this nonprofit matters to you, you get to hear yourself say it. That's gold. And then to pursue each of the other decisions in as much detail as necessary and as much detail as the donor wants to give to it. Mm. You know, I get to control the agenda, but the donor controls the timeline.
Right. Very interesting. Yeah. So often we want to create a timeline and we just want to go in and talk about the charity and what great things they're doing. And what I hear you saying is that we really should be, you know, drilling down on why they care and about what we do that the donor's interested in.
Absolutely. Unless you want the $500 go away and don't bother me gift.
Go away money. Yeah. Very, very, very true. And we all get some of that go away money, that's for sure. Sometimes we even leave that on the table because we never get to what the donor really wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm. We're in a relationships business. A charitable gift is a happy byproduct.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let me pivot and talk about something else. And this really was one of the key reasons why Andrew and I wrote our little book on fundraising called Rainmaking, and that was the silos that we saw being created inside nonprofit organizations, whether it's between the major gift team and the marketing team, whether it's between the major gift officer and the plan giving officer. Talk to me about your philosophy with the silos that are created internally and how to avoid some of that.
Roy, you've invited me to speak on my favorite soapbox issue. I just thought I'd warn you about that.
All right, we'll climb up on the box.
It's a big box, right?
Well, I am hoping to get more and more frontline fundraisers up on this box with us, because here goes. During my checkered career, I worked as both, and I have the business cards to prove it, a major gift fundraiser and a planned gift fundraiser. If we had video, you'd see me using air quotes. And after a while, it dawned on me, especially after I had my epiphany, that sitting across that coffee table, they didn't care what my job title was. They wanted me to be competent. They wanted me to be trustworthy. My job was to help that couple sitting across that coffee table find the gift plan that was best for them, whether it was going to be a current or a testamentary or a life income gift. My job across the coffee table is to help them plan their gift. I am all for tearing down those silos and creating, in all of my students, it's what I aim to do, major gift planners, frontline fundraisers who are increasingly capable of finding the gift that's available from that donor.
Very interesting. Yeah, you know, it's one of the things I have struggled with, trying to establish a major gift plan for a particular family that keeps them engaged. I found that if I really push for a high stretching, one-time big gift, that then they want to take a year or two or three break after they make that huge gift. And it's interesting to hear you talk about this major gift planning process You know, it might be better to have them make a multi-year pledge than to write it all up front if they make it up front and go away. I'm amazed looking at different caseloads and just how many donors will be one and done. They make that big gift and then they think they can take a break now.
Well, that's why there is the stewardship phase of the relationship. And I remind students all the time, with very few exceptions, there's only one reason for stewardship. It's the next gift. Mm. Whether the gift you just secured was a $25,000 5-year pledge or a $150,000 charitable remainder unit trust, you have an opportunity to actively stay in touch with that donor, to ask continually, how is your giving feel to you? Feeling questions are my favorites because charitable giving at its heart is an emotion-based decision. Mm. But then continue deliberately to have those stewardship check-ins, and whether it's at the end of the, say, the fourth year of the 5-year pledge, or after the family has been receiving income from the charitable trust for maybe 3 or 4 years, my intent is, through deliberate stewardship, to invite a conversation about what would you like to do next. Mm. I create those opportunities. Mm. Let them tell me no.
Well, that's a whole presentation right there. There's a book there. What do you want to do next?
It's what we do for a living, and it's so easy for fundraisers to lose sight of that. I said it again, we're in the relationships business. Why do you want to divorce somebody who's fallen in love with you?
Right. Very true.
A follow-up on that, you know, as we're talking about everything that's going on politically and with our tax environment and the changes that are happening there, you know, I've heard a lot of people recently expressing concern, not so much about their major donors, although there's concern there, but really about kind of the mid-level of their file, right? That those donors might become more episodic than consistent in their giving because that creates tax advantages for them. And for many of those donors, there's not the kind of ongoing face-to-face engagement and relationship that there is for a donor who's, you know, a portfolio-managed major donor. I'm wondering, Dan, if you have some thoughts or recommendations for our listeners on how they might change what they're doing and how they're engaging those mid-level donors to create the same kind of stewardship feedback loop that you're talking about, you know, for donors that maybe they've never talked to before.
Yeah, I don't spend much time in that space. My work has been for the last 20 years with major gifts. Depending upon where I was working at the time, I was always focused on looking for the people in my constituency who had what appeared to be the capacity to make a gift of blank dollars or more. But especially because of the current tax situation, the political climate, et cetera, it's really good, especially for fundraisers in smaller nonprofits who really have to dig deeply into their portfolios to find their next generation of major donors, to think about the implications of what's going on in society. And the idea of episodic donors is something that's brand new, with the tax exemption limit being raised so much. The initial feedback we're getting this year is that a number of people aren't making the size gifts they were in years past because they can't enjoy an income tax charitable deduction. So they're bundling, you know, and since this is the first year of the new tax law, the projection is that some people might make a significant gift this year, but maybe not make a gift at all next year because they can't afford to give enough next year to be able to enjoy the charitable deduction. And again, that's a prediction. And I think fundraisers are smart to anticipate that and work on their stewardship in order to talk with people. And I think the real key is to discover from this donor, from that donor, what are your limitations? What are your parameters? Are you thinking about maybe missing a year or two in your support of our organization for tax-related concerns? Mm. Now, if you make that a deliberate conversation, you invite a conversation about taxation. you invite a conversation about what is your income? What is your taxable income? How much of your income do you generally budget for charitable giving? Boy, those are great questions to get answered. I think that's information I could work with. Turn it to your advantage. Be intentional.
Yeah, and, you know, the whole bundling phenomenon, of course, is really for those people who, you know, I mean, you're really talking about, they got to break that $12,000 cap for $24,000 per family. You know, if you're writing off that much, it's pretty good income. You know, it's still not going to be on the top end of what most people view as major giving. It, you know, by some standards, it would be, you know, that $10,000 to $25,000 gift, you know, is certainly a will be missed if people start to bundle and roll it from one year to the next.
Yeah, again, that's an area that I don't spend a whole lot of time on, but we've got to be sensitive to fundraisers who are working for different size nonprofits and be as supportive of everybody's needs as we possibly can. So I'm really glad to have brought the topic up. But again, the fundraiser shouldn't get into self-limiting mentality to assume that because the deduction limit has raised that some of my donors won't want to give again. Rather than assuming about this or that donor, we'll go visit them and ask them, have a conversation.
That's just, you know, a great recommendation in general. I find that so frequently one of the battles that we have to fight is this difference between a fundraiser's gut feel and what the donor and the data tell us. I mean, and Roy, I know you hear this all the time, but you know, I hear things like, well, my major donors, you know, people in my portfolio, they don't ever want to get direct mail. They hate direct mail.
And then except for the ones who do.
Fair enough. Yes. You know, my donor never wants to come to an event. My donors, they're not event people. Or
except for the ones who are.
Right. And so I think, you know, that you know, what you said about, you know, don't assume, go ask, in relation to this tax issue, that's key, but just in general too. I mean, I think more of that is necessary than what we currently have in the market. I find that so, and it's shocking to me in a relationship business that so many fundraisers are just reluctant to go have that kind of conversation.
That gets to another one of my soapbox issues. It's the lack of training for frontline fundraisers on how to effectively get those first appointments. When I started, there was nothing available in our space to teach me how to call people to ask them to meet with me. And it took me 2 or 3 years of groping and stumbling around before I figured out how to get people to say, yes, will you meet with me? And I think it's really important that fundraisers have some coaching, some instruction on how they can intentionally pursue. Well, it gets back to that first decision, my tongue-in-cheek way of saying it a little while ago. Why do I want to meet with a fundraiser? Why do I care enough about this nonprofit to accept a meeting with Dan Shepherd? Well, since I know that whether they could articulate it or not, they're thinking exactly that, I think that before I pick up the phone, I'm going to come up with a compelling reason why I want to see you. I want to come visit with you next week because, and then I finish that sentence, whether it's 1 point or 2 points, and only then do I pick up the telephone. I want to set the agenda. And when somebody says, okay, I'll agree to see you, as far as I'm concerned, they just agreed to my agenda.
I think, too, the industry today, technology, it's amazing to me that there are charities that have never met a donor because they haven't had to. And just using the technology of the internet and email and direct mail, of course, and they really believe that they can get bigger gifts without this one-on-one face-to-face engagement. It really isn't a mass marketing approach, is it, Dan?
Well, I think to the pie graph that's at the front of each year's issue of Giving USA, where it shows that something like 70 2% of all charitable gifts nationwide are from individuals, not from corporations, not from events, et cetera, et cetera. And to think that mass mailings and events fundraising would create that volume of charitable giving each year, well, that's just not rational thinking.
Right.
And when we talk about the 80-20 rule, or what people are saying these days, it's more like 90% of the money comes from 10% of the donors. And, you know, cliches like that are based on statistical history. If you want to continue to rely on bulk mail, then I'm fine, because I'm going to be the fundraiser. I'm your friendly competitor, by the way, who's going to call on your donor who just wrote you a $1,000 check based on something she received in the mail. And I'm going to be talking with her about a $50,000 gift. So thank you for staying out of my way.
You know, the real people that get this, I mean, again, I'm not opposed to these mass marketing techniques. As a matter of fact, some people would say that's kind of been my background, is reaching into those direct response files, finding the people with capacity, and then getting that face-to-face. But so many charities are just, candidly, I think they're just lazy. They don't go to the next step to apply these major gift principles to treat major donors like they expect to be treated.
Yeah, I absolutely endorse that. And lazy is certainly part of it. Some of them are afraid of trying new things. It gets back to the thing that you have to do.
Probably is the biggest.
If you want to start developing major gifts, you have to get on the telephone. You have to put yourself out there and take a risk. And there are some nonprofits that think they're doing okay with direct mail that simply aren't willing to take the extra risk. And what's really sad is that they're not willing to ask their donors, how much do you really care about us? It's self-denial, and it makes no sense to me.
Very interesting.
I had a charity just a few weeks ago, a large organization in the disability care space. They are spending over $13 million on direct mail, and they don't have a single full-time employee dedicated to major giving.
And they're leaving millions and millions of dollars on tables.
Oh, it's even better.
That's their choice.
The average age of the donor on their file is over 70 years old. So just imagine the lost opportunity for legacy giving as well.
Oh my goodness. You know, my advice to anybody who looks like that, who just might listen to this podcast, is hire somebody and give that person a year just to see what he or she can stir up. Just find out, satisfy your curiosity. I think you might be pleasantly surprised.
Yep.
Well, Dan, one thing, you know, as we kind of close things out here, you know, one of the things that, as we started, just talking about the impact you've had on me and hundreds of others, and just learning to be a good listener and pivoting and really paying attention to what the donor's telling you. How would you summarize this type of gift planning that you have taught so many?
It's a really simple idea for me. Don't ask for a contribution. Instead, ask for a conversation.
Mm.
And once you understand that if you get to yes, the conversation is going to be about why do you care? What do you care especially about? How can you best afford to do something about that? And then finally, will you make that commitment? Well, at the end of that, you're asking for the contribution. You're a horse in front of your cart.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and just affirming to me that I haven't got off track over the last decade. The same kind of stuff these principles are just as applicable today as they were a decade ago. You know, I just thank you for your tenacity and your service to the industry. And I just think about the thousands of donors that you've served throughout your career. I mean, it is just amazing and humbling to have some time with you today.
Well, I thank you both for giving me the platform. And it really is humbling to think of the work that we do as fundraising professionals. It's a privilege to work with people who care about various causes to the point where they can afford to do something significant in support of those causes. I've been thankful for my career every day I've done this work.
Well, we're thankful for you. Andrew, well, we've wrapped up, I think, a pretty good interview here.
Yeah, this was great.
2 hours.
I really appreciate you joining us today. I mean, such great, great insights. Tell everybody again how they can get a hold of you if they're looking for help with their major gift program or with donor engagement.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Well, my moniker, as Roy pointed out, is the Frontline Fundraiser. The name of my company is The Shepherd Group, but you can reach me by email at dan@thefrontlinefundraiser.com. My website is thefrontlinefundraiser.com. And if you want to call me on the phone and chat, it's 843-693-5719.
Awesome. Thank you again so much, Dan. Really appreciate you being here today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising so that you can change the world. You can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.